Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the state of the Middle East and the direction of Trump administration foreign policy. We'll spend this hour with Douglas Silliman, who retired recently after a long career in the Foreign Service, most recently as U.S. ambassador to Iraq. We'll talk about why tensions have flared between the United States and Iran and what each side has to gain and lose from additional acts of aggression. We'll also talk about how the U.S. killing of Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani has complicated U.S.-Iraqi relations since the assassination took place on Iraqi soil. Our conversation starts after a short break. Of tension between the United States and Iran has been dramatic. The U.S. withdrew from the international deal to limit Iran's nuclear development, the JCPOA. Iran launched multiple attacks on U.S. allies. The U.S. assassinated a highly ranked Iranian security official on Iraqi soil. And Iran retaliated for that attack with missile strikes on U.S. military targets in Iraq. Not surprisingly, Iraqis are deeply concerned, outraged, to find themselves at the center of this conflict. And the Iraqi parliament voted recently to expel more than 5,000 U.S. troops stationed there to train Iraqi security forces. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We wanted to understand how recent events have complicated the U.S.-Iraqi relationship and conditions in the broader region, so we have invited Ambassador Douglas A. Silliman to talk about this. He has recently retired after serving as U.S. ambassador to Iraq from 2016 to 2019 and U.S. ambassador to Kuwait from 2014 to 16. He's also served diplomatic missions in Turkey, Jordan, Pakistan, Haiti, and Tunisia. Ambassador Silliman, welcome to Think.
Chris, I'm really happy to be in Dallas and to be here on KERA on Think.
Wonderful. So we have seen months of demonstrations by young Iraqis calling for both the U.S. and Iran to sort of get out of their business. What are their chief concerns about the U.S. presence?
Well, frankly, there are very few concerns that they have about the U.S. presence. The concerns are really about their own futures. And the reality of Iraq right now is that the economy does not work well. The government is largely corrupt. It is overly bureaucratized. And most Iraqis have grown up believing that when they graduate from high school or college, the government will give them a job. Last year, 2018, the government provided about 42,000 jobs. But in 2020, nearly a million new Iraqis will join the labor market. So there is a huge gap between their expectations and what the government is able to provide. In addition to that, the mostly kids in their 20s and early 30s who have been protesting are Iraqi Shia in the southern part of the country, the people who have traditionally supported the mostly Shia-led government in Baghdad. So it is significant that the core of ethnic and religious support for this governing structure is now calling it into question. Can the government get rid of corruption? Can the government provide economic opportunities? And can the government control militias and criminal gangs, in many cases trained or sponsored by Iran currently or in the past, which have taken over local governance or simply conduct criminal activity all over Iraq, particularly in the Shia areas of the south? Though the protests aren't necessarily against the United States or even against Iran. It's against what a lot of young Iraqis see as the lack of a viable future.
Iraq is not without natural resources. So explain the problems with the economy.
One of the things that I was known to say in Iraq is that Iraq is a rich country. Iraq has oil and gas. Iraq also has quite a bit of water and arable land and a working 5,000-year-old irrigation system. Iraq has a history of respect for education, and Iraqis like to send their kids to school and help them with their homework at night. And it doesn't make sense that this country that has so much wealth, it's the second largest oil producer now in OPEC behind Saudi Arabia, is unable to manage the money. So there are essentially two big reasons. One is bureaucracy and the idea that the government needs to control the economy. This is true socialism, where the government controls the means of production and the government structures the economy and allocates resources, which is terribly inefficient, as we learned looking at the fall of the Soviet Union. But more importantly, there is corruption and criminality cut through the bureaucracy. And more than a decade of Iraqi politicians packing their political supporters into the bureaucracy in jobs that had no purpose has created opportunities for corruption throughout the bureaucracy. So if you need to, say, buy a piece of land to expand your business, it could take 100 signatures and months of work and walking around the different offices to get that done. And in many of those encounters with government bureaucrats, they will ask you for a favor or a bribe. And that means that as a business person, you don't really know how much it will cost you, how much time it will take. And as a person seeking a job, you're going to gravitate toward people that you know. Businesses or small shops owned by your family, you work for your cousin a lot. This just limits the size and the vibrancy and the vitality of the Iraqi economy, because the economy is still driven by oil and the government controls the oil and the spending of the oil money.
So the 5,000-odd U.S. troops that remain in Iraq are there, as I understand it, to continue training Iraqi security forces so that they can ultimately independently hold ISIS at bay and other forces that would be detrimental to Iraq and the broader region. Is that correct?
That's half of the reason.
Okay.
The main reason that U.S. forces and, frankly, a 17-member coalition of forces, in addition to a separate mission run by NATO, is to help the Iraqi government train its mainline security forces, the Army, the Air Force, the Navy, and something called the Counterterrorism Service, which is basically Iraq's special forces. But at the same time, we continue to work very closely with the Iraqis to try to sweep up the remaining elements of ISIS. U.S. soldiers are not in the field going against ISIS, but they do help the Iraqis with intelligence and intelligence analysis. They help the Iraqis plan missions that the Iraqis go on themselves and are, as I said, really mentoring the Iraqi security services to try to push back on this terrorist threat that has not yet reemerged, but if the pressure is relieved, could reemerge quickly.
I understand the framing of this as sort of U.S. largesse or benevolence to help Iraq. Are there also benefits to the U.S. of having those troops stationed on an ongoing basis in Iraq?
The main benefit that the United States gets from helping the Iraqi government increase its sovereignty is, frankly, providing the Iraqi government the ability to push back on other regional actors that want to influence it. And I'm speaking here particularly about Iran. What is interesting about the U.S. decapitation of the Iraqi government in 2003 is that when we went in, we took out Saddam Hussein, we took out the leadership of most of the government, we disbanded the armed forces, and left open for Iraqis all of the old fissures in Iraqi society to come back to the surface. So most people think of Sunni Muslim versus Shia Muslim, but there are also majority Arab versus minorities, Kurds, Christians, Yazidis. There are urban versus rural, educated versus less well-educated, religious versus secular. And all of these fissures have been woven into Iraqi society over decades, and they all came back to the surface. So what happened in the aftermath of removing Saddam Hussein in 2003 was that Iran, and particularly one general in the Iranian Quds Force named Qasem Soleimani, basically devised a plan to make Iran, to impose on Iraq, Iran-like security and governance and economic structures, trying to remake inside Iraq the way that the Revolutionary Guards and the religious leadership in Iran had taken control and governed Iran, with the creation of Shia militias, with the inserting into the government structure of Shia nationalist or pro-Iranian politicians or people from pro-Iranian parties, and more recently with attempts to control some large state enterprises so that these militia organizations can offer not only a militia job carrying a gun, but also a factory job or a service job, and control more economic output as well. So the United States cannot compete with Iran in Iraq on Iran's playing field. There is an 850-mile border between the two countries. There are thousands of years of history. There are tribal, religious, family relationships that go back and forth across the border. What the United States can do is help Iraq develop its own sovereignty. We have been trying since 2003 to help Iraqis develop a new sense of an Iraqi identity, some of which was lost when Saddam was pulled down. And what we can do best, especially with our European and developed Asian partners, is to help the Iraqis build a real economy that will provide jobs and opportunities for those million new Iraqis every year who enter the job market. So it's a very long-winded way around your question, but the best way for the United States in Iraq to block Iran's hegemonic designs in Iraq is to strengthen Iraqi institutions, not for the United States to be there on our own for the long term. And that has been the U.S. policy more or less since 2003. Until maybe a few months ago, and now I think that American policy in Iraq is seen much more through the lens of Iran policy than it had been during the previous administrations in the first couple of years of the Trump administration.
A lot of Iraqis saw the U.S. killing of Soleimani on their soil as a U.S. violation of Iraqi sovereignty. Is that a reasonable position for them to take?
Whether it's a reasonable position for them to take or not is really immaterial. That is what many Iraqis believed. And what was interesting is before the killing of Soleimani in Iraq, a lot of the Iraqi demonstrators we talked about earlier were chanting, Iran, Iran, burra, burra, Iran, Iran, out, out. After the killing, you saw a little bit of America, America, burra, burra, Iran, Iran, burra, burra, America out, Iran out. But the demonstrators in the streets don't have the same kind of deep anxiety about the American presence that they do about the Iranian presence and Iranian meddling, because they see what the Iranians do every day of their lives, and the American presence is far removed from them. I think over time, popular concern about an American or Western military presence will dissipate, especially if the Trump administration and our NATO and coalition partners can reframe, restructure, and, if you will, re-advertise why those forces are there and what the ultimate goal of having the forces there for Iraq actually is. So I think over time it will probably lessen. Unfortunately, the killing of Soleimani brought America back into this conflict in a way that we had not been in before. But I've talked to a number of Iraqis who, frankly, were not concerned that the United States actually killed Soleimani. They were just very upset that the United States did it in Iraq. And it was that hit to their sovereignty, to their pride in their country, which is what they feel from that assassination. Whether you like Soleimani or didn't like Soleimani, everybody felt that national shock. But a lot of people are happy that Soleimani is gone because he is seen as he is the mastermind, the strategist, and the chief tactician of Iran's move into Iraq over the past 15 years.
Is an assassination of that nature by the United States the kind of thing that the State Department is warned about before it's carried out?
The best answer is it depends, and I don't know in this specific case what the answer is. In some areas where we have been conducting military operations against individuals, there is great coordination, at least at the senior levels of the State Department and embassies overseas. In this case, I simply don't know. This was such a sensitive operation, it may have been more closely controlled. And there are, interestingly, two separate chains of command from the president, one to the civilian government and one to the military part of the government. And they are independent and each take orders independently from the president and the White House. So it is possible for military operations to be conducted without the civilian side knowing. But in general, that's not the case.
My guest is Ambassador Douglas A. Silliman. He was U.S. Ambassador to Iraq from 2016 to 2019. Before that, he served as Ambassador to Kuwait. We're talking today about Iraq, the United States, and relations in the Middle East. We'll be right back.
The Iraqi government let us down, letting them get as close as they got to the compound of the embassy.
So early this morning, I made clear when I spoke with the Iraqi leadership that the Iraqis had the responsibility to keep our facility safe.
Did they live up to that?
They've responded. They brought counterterrorism forces to bear. We reminded them throughout the day of their continued responsibility, and we told them where we thought there was risk and things weren't happening the way we needed it to happen. And so we'll make sure they continue to live up to their obligation to help keep our facility safe.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Douglas A. Silliman, who recently retired from the State Department, served as U.S. Ambassador to Iraq from 2016 to 2019. What you just heard was Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on CBS News in December, explaining the obligation that Iraqi officials have when it comes to providing security for the U.S. Embassy in Iraq. First of all, what sort of training is there for people who work at the State Department to respond in the event of a breach of State Department facilities?
Well, first of all, I need to explain what the American Embassy in Baghdad looks like. It looks like an armed camp. And on the inside, it's essentially a more than 100-acre junior college campus with office buildings and housing and recreation facilities surrounded by a big wall with concertina wire at the top. So this is not our consular office in Benghazi. This is not even the U.S. Embassy in Tehran in 1979. And we have more than 1,000 people whose job it is to secure that compound and keep everybody inside safe. So Americans need to understand that a lot of U.S. government resources and taxpayer dollars went into making this a safe diplomatic platform so that it would be very difficult to get to and harm those people who live inside. Now, that said, the embassy has been under attack by normally militia or armed elements, whether it is Al-Qaeda or ISIS or Shia militias, for most of the period since 2007-2008. And it is, in fact, the government of Iraq's international obligation to keep that facility safe and to protect it. And as somebody who spent five of my last 10 years in that compound, I can tell you the Iraqi government has not lived up to that obligation to the United States or to the world. Part of the problem is the groups that have conducted attacks have been largely terrorist groups or groups outside the control of the government. As I said, Al-Qaeda in the past or Shia militias often supported by Iran. But in 2016, there was a major change. The Iraqi parliament brought into the formal government structure something called the Popular Mobilization Forces. Essentially, the majority of those were Iranian-sponsored, sometimes very pro-Iranian, Shia militias. Those were the same forces who had been shooting at and killing American soldiers during the surge and until the withdrawal in 2011, and who have been attacking the embassy regularly but not frequently in the past several years. When I looked at the film of the attack on the embassy in early January, the people who I saw in front of the embassy supporting the attack were the National Security Advisor and the head of the Popular Mobilization Forces, the deputy commander, and the commanders of several of the militias who are now actually government security employees. So it was clear that the Iraqi government was unable to keep them away from the American embassy. And I think it is not a matter of lack of will on the part of the Iraqi government, it's lack of capability and, frankly, fear of what might happen to individuals who actually attempt to prevent these militias from conducting activity that is not directed by the prime minister as commander-in-chief. They don't play by the same rules. Many of these militias are government security forces by day and criminal organizations by night and do smuggling and extortion. So it is the Iraqi government is in a very difficult position because Shia nationalist and pro-Iranian politicians have now put these structures into the structure of the government, without any way for a generally fairly weak prime minister to control them. And Secretary Pompeo noted that he had been in contact with the Iraqi government to make sure they understood their obligations, I had dozens and dozens of conversations over the years with Iraqi prime ministers, with foreign ministers, defense ministers, and members of parliament about their international obligations. They all get it, but they really are not able to execute it because of the fact that these militias are essentially independent actors outside the control of the elected government.
So what are the limitations of the jurisdiction of the United States to effectively keep your people safe in the embassy with American forces?
That's not a particularly clear question under international law. While U.S. forces were in Iraq before 2011, U.S. military forces conducted many, many raids against people where we believed planning was going on to attack U.S. forces under the name of self-defense. I think you can make a very strong argument that the use of U.S. military forces inside Iraq to prevent people who are planning to attack us from attacking us would be legal under international law. The question is going to be, what will be the impact of those policies? If we were to again directly target, probably not with troops on the ground, but maybe with airstrikes like the one that killed General Soleimani, what would the blowback be? Would that put people in the embassy at greater risk, or would it reduce the risk? And this is the kind of trade-off that security people and Secretary Pompeo and others in Washington, and certainly Ambassador Tulur, who is the current ambassador, have to make every single day.
I don't want to get too far afield on this, but I do have some questions. With word that the State Department has made plans to evacuate personnel who were at diplomatic facilities in Wuhan, China, because of the outbreak of the coronavirus there, is the State Department inclined to sort of act out of an abundance of caution, or does that evacuation suggest a U.S. perception that this is a serious and ongoing threat?
Certainly since the attack on the U.S. consular office in Benghazi in 2012, both the Obama administration and the Trump administration have acted out of an abundance of caution to prevent casualties, certainly from violence. The Wuhan evacuation has more to do with, if you will, a natural disaster, a tsunami, an earthquake, where you have not only American diplomats or military personnel assigned to an embassy or a consulate, you also have spouses and you have children and you have responsibilities that go beyond just the people who work in the mission. So I think in this case, it really is to try to make sure that the children of American diplomats and employees who are in schools are not exposed to the coronavirus. And it makes perfect sense to me, and this is something that is done fairly quickly in other places where there is physical danger or danger from a natural disaster for our employees and their families overseas. So I don't see anything particularly significant about the determination that the Wuhan coronavirus is any more or less virulent. It is rather, we need to take care of our people first as we figure out what we're going to do in terms of public health.
Okay, my other question is this. Presumably the Chinese government has the same obligation under international law to sort of protect and defend those U.S. diplomatic facilities in Wuhan. What exactly happens when every American who works at a diplomatic outpost leaves? How do you secure the facility knowing that the folks guarding the place are commanded by people who would very much like to get in and see things that the United States government would rather keep to itself?
My assumption is that the government of China will want to abide by its international obligations, and it has generally worked relatively well. For example, we have a consulate in the southern Iraqi city of Basra, which has been closed, and it's been guarded by Iraqi security forces since the operations were suspended. And earlier in my career, 20 years ago, there was a period where the U.S. embassy in Beirut, Lebanon, was evacuated for a long, long time. We essentially gave the keys to our locally hired security forces. And then a year and a half later, when we came back, everything was in great shape. So we also have local Chinese employees who will help keep things operating properly and make sure that there are no incursions. Again, the government of China has other ways to try to collect information on the United States, and it would be fairly obvious if they were going to, you know, break into any of our facilities that were evacuated right now, and it would be counterproductive, I think. So I have a little more trust in the Chinese government to do things in the old-fashioned clandestine way rather than right up front.
All right. I want to pivot a little bit more specifically to the relationship between the United States and Iran at the moment. President Trump and many of his supporters had very strong feelings about the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, otherwise known as the Iran nuclear deal. They felt it was bad for the interests of the United States. What specifically are the goals of the Trump administration from its relationship with Iran in the moment?
That's a really good question, and I actually don't know. And that's one of the things that worries me. I had numerous conversations in my time in Iraq and before with senior Trump administration officials. And the policy came down to several different variations, and I'll lay them out. There was a pretty small minority that felt it was necessary to use U.S. military power to pull down the government in Tehran. I don't think that anyone at a very senior level is thinking that way, but that idea is floating around inside the government in some circles.
Excuse me for interrupting you. So that's not the kind of idea that's floating around typically, as far as you know, in your long career in the Foreign Service.
No, but in other words, people are looking at maybe we can do in Iran something like President Bush did in Iraq in 2003. A lot of people also say, look how Iraq turned out. Is this really what we want to do? A second option for a policy goal that I think is probably has a wider audience in the administration is the hope that the economic pressure on Iran will simply cause the Iranian regime to collapse of its own weight. I personally don't think that's very realistic. It hasn't worked in North Korea, in Venezuela, in Cuba. And when you have a repressive dictatorship that puts down protests by killing the protesters generally don't win. So I think that's a hope that a significant number of senior people in the administration have, but I cannot imagine that it's going to happen. And even if it did, there is no clear alternative government except for the people who are, you know, factions of the people who are currently running the government. So you might get a more extreme Shia government. You might get a more secular but repressive security-focused government. But you're unlikely to get a Western-leaning democracy that wants to plug into a worldwide free market economy.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd.
What is probably more important, there are a number of people who are looking to change Iranian policies that bump up against American national interests and the interests of our friends, particularly Israel and the Arab Gulf states, in three or four areas. First of all, in nuclear weapons. Certainly Israel and the United States do not want to see Iran develop a nuclear weapon, but the U.S. retreat from the JCPOA and now Iran's giving up on its five key commitments means that right now we are with the Iranian nuclear program in terms of international controls where we would have been in 2029 had the JCPOA stayed in place. There are a lot of indications that Iran is interested in renegotiating some sort of a new deal and that they might even include more things in it. And Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif over the summer laid out three potential slightly different scenarios under which that might happen. So issue number one in terms of policy is nuclear weapons. Issue number two is ballistic and other missiles. You saw the attacks by Iran on two Iraqi bases that housed U.S. and coalition forces a couple of weeks ago. That was done with short-range ballistic missiles. They were reasonably accurate, and they have now been able to use those missiles for their own strategic value. And I believe, looking also at the attacks on Saudi Arabian oil infrastructure last September, which were conducted by land attack cruise missiles and drones, Iran can now project its strategic power through conventional systems without the need to have a nuclear weapon, at least in the region. So there are people who need to look at how can the United States and the countries in the region and Israel constrain what Iran is doing with its missile program so that it does not become more dangerous. A third area is Iran's support for its proxies. And under the maximum pressure campaign, the amount of money that they've been able to spend on their proxies has gone down, and we've seen changes. And there seem to be fewer Iranian less Iranian interference in Bahrain and the eastern province of Saudi Arabia. I'm not sure about Pakistan and Afghanistan quite so much. But the Iranians have doubled down on Iraq and on Syria and on Lebanon and their allies and proxies there. So they have focused their effort in this particular strain. This was the main issue that the Gulf states objected to in the JCPOA, the Obama negotiated plan. And they really were not consulted in the process of negotiation because it was largely done with the Europeans and the permanent UN Security Council members. There's a fourth area that I think is of particular interest to Vice President Pence, and that's a broader question of human rights. How are political opponents in Iran treated? How are minorities, Baha'i, Zoroastrians, Christians treated? And then I know that President Trump is very interested in the number of American and British dual Iranian, American and Iranian British citizens who are currently in custody. This is another issue that people would like to address. So it seems to me more realistic to chart a strategy based on a desire to make specific changes or modifications to Iranian policy than to hope for the downfall of the regime.
So if I hear you right, the Iranians are not specifically interested in possessing a nuclear weapon for its ability to blow things up. They're interested in potentially possessing a weapon for the leverage it buys them.
Maybe the most important reason for most average Iranians is that it would show that Iran is a great country and a great civilization that has been able to develop this weapon on its own. And you shouldn't discount the social and cultural importance of that. But more directly, unless it was going to try to pose a direct threat to Israel to destroy Israeli cities, it's more leverage. Think during the Soviet time, the United States and the Soviet Union had the Mutually Assured Destruction Pact, where each side had so many nuclear weapons that the consequences for using them would be traumatic for both sides and for the entire world. Iran would like to have that kind of ability to project its strategic power without having to use it. So there is some benefit to having a nuclear weapon, but there are also a lot of strings that come attached. It causes huge political problems with other countries. It's very expensive to develop and maintain. And what I was seeing in the government in the year or so before I left is that Iran seemed to be placing more importance on its far less expensive and far more flexible missile programs to project strategic influence. It is possible to go back into a negotiation with the Iranians in some way that would impose greater limits on the Iranian nuclear program. The Iranian supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has actually issued a fatwa, a religious ruling, against nuclear weapons in Iran. So there is religious legitimacy behind the idea that Iran will not develop a nuclear weapon.
My guest is Ambassador Douglas A. Silliman, recently retired from the State Department after serving most recently as U.S. Ambassador to Iraq. We'll be right back. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq. He served from 2016 to 2019 in that position, Douglas A. Silliman, recently retired from the State Department. How would you characterize U.S.-Iranian relations at the moment? I mean, there is no direct diplomatic relationship, so help me understand how communication works, because we know there is communication happening.
There is very little communication happening because all the chains of communication go through third parties. There is a Swiss channel that you've read about in the press that is relatively good, but it's moderately slow. But what the Trump administration lacks is direct access to anybody serious in the Iranian regime. During the Obama administration, a U.S. naval vessel in the Gulf had mechanical problems and drifted into Iranian waters and were captured by the Quds Force Navy. And the sailors were very publicly mistreated by the Quds Force Navy. There was a channel that existed between Secretary of State Kerry and Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif, which they immediately engaged in to de-escalate and to make sure that the ships and the sailors were as quickly as possible turned back over to the U.S. Navy. What worries me is the kind of tit-for-tat escalation that we witnessed starting on the 27th of December of last year could easily escalate if each side is only looking at the public statements of the other. I have some confidence that neither Tehran nor President Trump want a shooting war with each other, but I'm afraid that military commanders, people in the chain of command might overreact, and governments might do things or have things happen accidentally, like the shooting down of the Ukraine International Airline right after the Iranian missile attack on the Iraqi bases, that could further escalate and cause the other side to do something beyond what they had planned on doing. So right now, there are not enough channels of communication. When I was in Iraq, we tried to find third parties who could convey messages, but you're never sure how the message is conveyed. You never are sure how it's watered down or beefed up, and you can't count on a quick or accurate response. It's best to have some sort of direct channel of communications, which, as far as I know, we do not have now with Tehran.
Did the nature of your job feel very different when you were serving in the Trump administration than in previous administrations?
The nature of my job didn't change much. The nature of the decision-making process between the two administrations was very different, but I served under six presidents, and each president, and sometimes each Secretary of State or National Security Advisor or Secretary of Defense, had radically different ideas of how policy should be made, even within the same, from administration one to administration two of the same president. As somebody who is a career diplomat, swore an oath to the Constitution of the United States, you adjust to the leadership style of the administration in power, and we did our best to adjust to the leadership style of President Trump and his team.
As I'm sure you're aware, some Americans don't really believe that it's possible to serve equally faithfully under presidents who are Democrats and presidents who are Republicans, based on whatever their individual political leanings might be. Can you talk a little bit about how you, as a human being, learn to set aside your own sense of how things should be in order to fulfill your obligations as someone who has taken a sworn oath to serve whoever the president is?
The reality is that a president of the United States does not issue really specific instructions. They give broad orders. We want to try to expand economic ties between the United States and country X. And generally is left to the bureaucracy and professionals to figure out how is the best way to do that. How do you get American companies interested? How do you get country X's companies interested? And what the presidents are concerned about is the net result. If economic activity drops by 10%, you haven't succeeded. If it increases by 10%, or there are five new company relationships, you have succeeded. So presidents are not as down in the details of foreign policy as many people think. So that gives people like me the ability to, I don't want to say interpret because that's not quite the right word, take the instructions of a president or a secretary of state and figure out how to make them work wherever I am. And that is the value of diplomats, to use the relationships that I have, the experience that I have, and the influence of the United States to leverage to the result desired by the president. So there's a lot of leeway given in the implementation of orders, and sometimes it's done effectively, and other times it's not done effectively. Generally, career diplomats and career senior military officers are engaged in the policy process. But very seldom are we the final deciders. The decisions are in Washington, and when you're overseas, you try to find the best way to implement those decisions. One thing that I will say that I have felt throughout my career, and I think I feel it very keenly in the Trump administration, is a conflict in American foreign policy between American interests and American values. And this ebbs and flows. If you think back to the Cold War era, where we were opposing the Soviet Union, we were also putting millions and millions of dollars into agricultural development in countries that were largely associated with the Soviet Union, or at least sympathetic to the Soviet Union, because we felt we had to do our best to increase the livelihoods, the quality of life of people in India or Bangladesh or Southeast Asia.
That's the American values part of
the
equation.
That's the American values part. Even in this administration, you have got a president and often a secretary of state who very clearly define American interests as financial benefits to Americans and American taxpayers. you still have a vice president who's very interested in the health of the Christian community and minority communities and human rights in many parts of the world. So every administration has a mixture of what they consider to be the most important American interest overseas, and it's counterposed against what people in that same administration believe are the most important American values to pursue during their administration. It's the values part that tends to shift around a little bit, but that that conflict, that tension, has always existed throughout my entire career.
It's worth pointing out that the United States is not alone in wanting to sort of draw a ring around Iran's regional influence, certainly curtail Iran's nuclear capability. We unilaterally pulled out of the JCPOA, but what kinds of collaborative efforts can still be made with the other former partners in the JCPOA in trying to achieve, if nothing else, common ends in our relationships with Iran.
A couple of things I would suggest, and the first of which is simply stop conducting foreign policy negotiations publicly. It's not effective, and it tends to make our allies think that we are not going to consider any of their viewpoints or any of their interests in pursuing our policy. The second piece is to consult with our friends and allies who are most affected by the decisions that we are going to make. So if you want to restore controls on Iran's nuclear weapons program, you need to go back and talk to the people who in the past have helped the United States restore controls on Iran's nuclear weapons program, which is Britain, France, Germany, and the European Union, and also Russia and China. And probably need to bring Israel into it because they are the ones in the region in a way that they were not brought in during the negotiations of the JCPOA. That's a core group that needs to come to consensus on what would be the best way to constrain an Iranian nuclear weapons program in the future. But you also have to make sure that we are talking to our European partners and our Arab partners about ballistic missiles, about Iranian support for proxies, things that affect Arab neighbors or Europeans if they have refugee flows coming into their countries. It is better if we can develop a consensus on those issues and how to limit missile programs, how to constrain Iran's interference in its neighbors' economies and in its neighbors' politics. And that probably requires for us to think about not only what will the sanctions on Iran be, but if Iran changes its behavior, what will Iran gain from those changes in behavior? So it's, I mean, to be very simplistic, it's carrot and stick. Up to this point, the Trump administration has really just applied sticks and have not defined why Iran should make the changes that we would like to see happen. We should first, before presenting it to Iran, have some sort of agreement with our key partners and allies who are like-minded and figure out what we can live with as incentives for Iran to change its behavior in the way that we want, in addition to the kinds of sanctions that we would continue to impose or impose in the future if they do not.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So I have just seen the broadest outlines of the Trump administration peace plan for the Middle East. You may be more familiar with the nuances and details. Can you talk about the most striking differences between this peace plan and previous American efforts?
The most striking difference is that the construction of this peace plan was essentially a bilateral American-Israeli agenda. What it looks like, and I must admit, I was reading through this very quickly. It's more than 100 pages long and very detailed. From my initial read, it appears that many of the ideas that were developed in 2000 with President Clinton's end of administration push on the peace process, many things that Israeli governments and particularly Benjamin Netanyahu did not like. But the administration went to Netanyahu and the Israeli government and said, how can you live with changes to Jerusalem? How do you accommodate Palestinians' insistence on having part of Jerusalem as their capital? What do you do with the question of Jewish refugees or Palestinian refugees? How do you make sure that a new Palestine can have a viable economy? And a bunch of other political questions as well, without any Palestinian input. So what you have, and it's actually most interesting looking at the couple of maps that are in the appendices, You have a non-contiguous, gerrymandered Palestinian state connected by tunnels and roads around Israeli settlements, which are going to be included into the state of Israel. Israel has insisted on control of the eastern border of what is currently the West Bank, the border with Jordan and along the Jordan River, and are claiming sovereignty over that space, but also over the airspace and most of the decisions that that a normal government of a Palestinian state might want to take. And many people didn't really understand, looking at the north end of the map, the Golan Heights, which have generally been recognized as part of Syria, is included in this map as part of Israel. So if this is a starting point for negotiations, it's a very specific starting point for negotiations, and there are many things in there which I think Palestinians and Arabs could suggest. Chief among those is the idea that there will be, at the end of this process, an independent, recognized Palestinian state. However, it depends upon the amount of flexibility on the part of Israel and on the part of the United States and the willingness of Palestinians to engage, you know, piece by piece on all of the hundreds of elements of this plan. The initial response from the Palestinian Authority was quite literally no, no, no. The initial response from America's friends and allies, with the exception of Jordan, was this is a serious proposal that could be a starting point for negotiations. So as I look at this, my fear is that it will completely change the basis on which the peace process is looked at in the future, probably to the detriment of Palestinians and maybe meaning that Palestinians will never seriously engage. But with some encouragement and flexibility on the part of the United States and Israel, maybe there is a way to turn this into a starting point for negotiations.
Do you think this was crafted? I mean, obviously, there are a lot of advantages in the initial proposal that seemed to go to the Israelis rather than the Palestinians. Do you think this was crafted to sort of shift the Overton window, the sort of frame in which all negotiations take place, and you can sort of move the starting point so that more radical ideas on one side just aren't even talked about anymore?
I think that's probably correct, because the frame of reference for most of the discussions between Israelis and Palestinians since 2000 has been the outlines of the proposal that Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak put on the table in the summer of 2000, which was independent Palestinian state, a shared capital of Jerusalem, no right of return for Palestinian refugees to the Israeli state, and a couple of other smaller elements. But there was a sense of balance between Israelis and Palestinians, and that if Israel wanted to incorporate settlements into Israel, there would be a real transfer of land to a Palestinian state that was of the same value as the land that Israel was going to take, not necessarily the same volume, but land that would be as valuable to the Palestinian state. I think that this could potentially change the frame of reference for the future very much in favor of Israel and make the Palestinians dig out of a deeper hole. And I'm afraid it will make it far more difficult for Palestinians to accept this process, since it was clear that it was developed over the past couple of years only with the consultation of Israel and, frankly, with very little consultation inside the U.S. government.
Douglas A. Silliman served as U.S. ambassador to Iraq from 2016 to 2019, U.S. ambassador to Kuwait from 2014 to 16. Ambassador Silliman, thank you so much for making time for us.
Chris, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.